please don't put them away. We would like you to tweet or share the conversation using hashtag SipHistory or hashtag History After Hours, which are in your program if you forget. So with that, thank you for your interest in this program. We're delighted to have a full house today. I will briefly introduce everyone on our distinguished panel because we really want to get to their stories. There are also short bios on each of our panelists in your program, so you can also learn more about them then. And then I also want to remind you that they will all be here after the program when we're enjoying wine and food on the other side of the museum. So do take advantage of this distinguished group of people here this evening. To my left is Stephen Spurrier, who ran a wine shop and school in Paris and organized the Paris Tasting in 1976. Next, we have George Tabor, the only journalist to cover the event, and that was for Time magazine. To his left is Warren Yarsky, founder of Stagseed Wine Cellars and the maker of the winning Cabernet Sauvignon. Next is Beau Barrett, whose family owns Chateau Montelena, and who was a winemaker there for over 30 years and is now the CEO of the winery. Next to Beau is Violet Gergich, whose father Mike, who is standing behind her, made the winning Chardonnay for Chateau Montelena in 1976 and went on to establish Gergich Hills Estate. And next to Violet is Ted Basler, CEO of St. Michel Estates, which now owns Stagseed Wine Cellars. So welcome to our panel.
To ask you to please set the stage for us and help us to understand the motivation for organizing the Paris tasting and what that was all about.
Well, as Paul said, I bought a wine shop in the Madeleine in 1971 and immediately acquired an Anglo-Saxon clientele, and I used to open bottles for them in the evenings, and they said, you know, if you could put this into a structured manner, we'd love to do a wine course. And so the premises next door came free and I took it over, and after a lot of transformations, opened L'Académie du Vin, which was the first private wine school in France, the first wine school in Paris, the first wine school opened by an Englishman. And because we were in the middle of Paris and we spoke English, we had, through 73, 74, and 75, visits from Californian winemakers who brought us wines, and visits from Robert Finnegan in particular, Alex Bespalov, wine writers who brought wines and told us how good they were. And Patricia Gallagher, an American girl whose family came over a little after, about 1690, not the first, but not too bad. She joined me as director of L'Académie du Vin in 73, and every July 4th, she tried to give tastings of American wine. Well, that was difficult because there weren't any in Paris. So when it became very plain to us that there was really something going on from California, Patricia said, we must do something about this. I said, of course we must. So she took her vacation, went to Napa, and met Warren and met Jim Barrett, and really pre-selected the wines. And she'd already, I said, you know, we must have a peg to hang all this on, because L'Académie du Vin was giving tastings, but we'd never given a tasting of California wine before. So she said the peg will be the celebration of the bicentennial of the War of Independence. And I said, that's not something we Brits normally celebrate. But I'll go along with it. And so Patricia came back in September 75 with lots of information. And we then set a date, May 24th, and my wife was in the audience here. She took all the photographs, by the way. If George hadn't been there, there'd been no articles, and if my wife hadn't been there, there'd have been no photographs. So anyway, she and I came over Easter time, 76, to make a final selection, but prior to that, we'd already rented, through a friend of mine, a wonderful space at the Intercontinental Hotel. We'd chosen the judges, and we had nine judges from the top echelons in France. L'Académie du Vin was very well thought of, because
We were a private school. We didn't ask money from anybody, which is not a real French habit. So we did not. And so when I called over to Milan and Pierre Brejou and this, that, and the other, they said, we'd love to come. Okay. I make the final selection over Easter time, April 76. I visited a couple of wineries which I hadn't been to. One was Fremark Abbey, Chalon, Spring Mountain maybe, and made the selection. And then, having bought two bottles of each, had 24 bottles on my hands. And it struck me, how on earth am I going to get these into Paris? Because I'd had a little problem with English white wine. And when the Queen came to visit Paris for the first time in her reign in 1972, Sir Guy Salisbury-Jones, who owned the Hambledon Vineyard in Hampshire, had said, could I have some of his English wine in my shop? I said, sure, I'd love to. So the six cases come over, they've flown into Orly, and I go and collect them, and I meet the customs officer, and he says, this wine doesn't exist. I said, well, it doesn't exist, because I can see it just behind you. He said, no, I can't clear it from customs because there's nothing in my papers for English wine. And so I went back the following day, and said, oh, Mrs. Gray, are you again? I said, yeah, I've come to clear the wine. He said, but you know it doesn't exist. I said, well, do you like your job? He said, yeah, bien sûr, I'm a customs officer, I like my job. I said, well, in 10 minutes, your wine won't exist, your job won't exist, because this wine has to be at the British Embassy tonight for the Queen and your president. Clearly, I didn't think that I could lie to such extent with 24 bottles of California wine coming into Orly. So thanks to Joanne Dickinson Dupree, who's also in the audience, she was heading up a tennis and wine tour with the great Andrei Chelichev, Louis Martini, and so many other people, and there were at least 20 of them, so they hand-carried the wine. So that's how they got to Paris. Otherwise, there might not have been any tasting at all. And one final, two final things. One, questions were asked, why weren't there some of the big boys, Beaulieu Vineyards, Mondavi? I only wanted to choose wine from what was called boutique wineries, because that's what we wanted to show, you know, real hands-on winemaking from people who are passionate about it. And the other thing, 2 weeks before the tasting happened, and it wasn't supposed to be a blind tasting, we were just proposing putting the wines to these nine judges to get, I hope, their approval, and to get just to show what was going on. We wanted to have visibility of the California wines. And it occurred to me that with one exception, Aubert de Villene, who owned the Romani Conti, still does, who was married to a girl from San Francisco, only Aubert would have ever tasted California wine before. And so the rest of them, I thought the risk was they know that California was on the west coast, somewhere north of Mexico, and they would think that it was a southern country, and they'd judge it like the south of Spain or the south of Italy. So I had the idea of putting in the four great wines from Bordeaux and four great wines from Burgundy as benchmarks and do it blind. And so when all the tasters turned up, everything was set up, I said, I've invited you to taste California wines, and I decided to change the rules, and if you don't agree, I'll change them back. And what we're going to do this afternoon is to have a blind tasting with the California wines that Patricia and I selected against the top wines from White Burgundy and top wines from Bordeaux. Do you agree? Pas de problème, they said. And the rest is history.
Invitations to various people in the press to attend this, and only one person actually accepted the invitation.
Well, we'd invited Le Monde, François, Figaro, Le Point, L'Express, Libération, and their newest, and the replies came back, no, it's not interesting. And luckily, George had been doing a wine course at La Catherine du Vin, and so he knew us, and Patricia called him 2 days before, and said, you know, we'd really like you to be here. And he said, well, if it's a slow day in the office, I'll come.
So George, was it a slow day at the office?
It was a slow day. It was a slow day. slow day. It was a Monday. In those days, Time Magazine went to press on Friday nights, and so Monday was the slowest day of the week. And it was a slow day, and it was because I had that connection. But, and also, I think there was another reason that I probably showed up, which was that I'm a native Californian. And I think I had that California connection, and so I was not a wine expert by any means, but I had only done one other wine story while I had been in France. But I decided to show up on the second invitation, and so early in the afternoon I showed up, and fortunately, at the beginning, as soon as I walked in, I was given probably by Patricia, because I already knew Stephen at that point, a list of the wines. The judges didn't have any idea of tasting order, but I had the tasting order. And the other thing that was very lucky was that I was the only journalist, because I think if there had been 10 journalists, 50 journalists, Stephen probably would have shoved us all into a corner and said, we'll tell you the results when it's all over. Because I was the only one, I had the freedom to roam around the room with, and the other question that was very important was that I was fluent in French. I'd been working in French-speaking countries by that point, Belgium, France, for about 7 years. So my French was quite good at that point. And so, you know, when the judges, I think Stephen would probably agree, they talked surprisingly a lot during the tasting. And I understood all of the things they were tasting. And it was about halfway through the white wine part of the competition that one of the judges held up a glass of wine, he swirled it around, and he tasted it, and then he held it up again, and he said, ah, back to France, obviously in French. And I looked at my scorecard, and he had just tasted Cremart Abbey Chardonnay. And I said to myself, hey, maybe I'm going to have a story here after. Because I went to the event really not thinking I was going to get a story.
Yeah. Tell us about filing that story. I mean, this is before the internet and the fast news. Tell us about the big story that you wrote and the small story that appeared in Time Magazine.
Well, that was the Time Magazine style of those days. Is the report in the field was assigned to write the whole story because they, the editors in New York would, you know, work it down to the amount of space that they had. And the story that appeared was the second story in the Modern Living section after the first story with the nobody ever paid attention to it because it was a story about a new theme park in Atlanta. Nobody's ever heard of whatever happened to that theme park in Atlanta. But the second story was only four paragraphs long. It was about 7 pages long that I wrote because I was supposed to, you know, in journalism terms, they say you're supposed to dump your cards, put everything in that you've got. And I was able to, with the help of Patricia, one of the judges, they had gotten the wines into Paris, the owner of Chateau Montemayor was in Paris at the time. And so Patricia lined it up, and so I was able to catch him in Paris at the winery. In fact, he told me later that he was sitting in a broom closet, and they told him, you know, he said he had just won this Paris tasting in the white part of the category. And he said to me later, he said, you know, what I was really worried about is I'd make a fool of myself and say something stupid. And so we chatted. He gave, you know, it was okay. He had good quotes. They said, you know, a little bit of the background of his winery. And then at the end of the camp conversation, he said, hey, that's not bad for kids from the sticks. I thought, hey, there's my quote. You got to have a quote at the end of the story. And that was the quote that went in at the end of the story.
Thank you. Warren. Warren, will you please set the stage for us about Stags Leap Wine Cellars in 1973 to 1976? What was it like?
I'll do my best. Actually, you had given me a shorter screening. You said you wanted to ask about three words.
I said it. If you could do it in three words, that'd be great.
No, not we can't do it in three words. But three words would describe the status. Young, and young. The vineyard was 3 years old. There is a story that only old vines make great wine. The young winery, the first winery, first year, we had just constructed the winery. So it was the first Cabernet made at this winery. And young, I had young colleagues, my family. It's here today. My wife and I are about the same age, but our children were involved. So Kasha, Julia, and Stephen, would you stand up? They were young. Everything about the winery, everything about the vineyard was young. I was old. I had completed 10 years of apprenticeship, and I was 35 when those apprentice years began. I worked for Lee Stewart, number two winemaker in a two-man winery, second man. Then I worked at Robert Mondavi in 1966, and I was the first winemaker at that winery when it began, its first year. Then I worked at a winery in Colorado, bringing grapes from California to Colorado and making wine. That was my apprenticeship. I was determined when we started our winery, I would put all that to good use. I wasn't going to make any mistakes. And I set my sights on making a beautiful wine. I didn't think of French wines. I didn't think they would be exceeded in any testing. It wasn't to duplicate. It wasn't to go beyond. It was to make the most beautiful wine I could from those grapes, from that place. It is said that Americans are hard to set limits. They tend to try the best they can in the places they are. And that was my effort. I was part of that. Do the best you can. Do it better than you can. Don't set limits, artificial limits. If I had said artificial limits, I would have said, French wines are undoubtedly the best in the world. But there were a number of French astronomers at that tasting, and they discovered that the sun does not only go around France.
Thank you, Warren. When Patricia Gallagher came to taste your wine, she must have thought it was wonderful.
She, in fact, fact, said that our Gamay Beaujolais at that time reminded her of Fleury, but she didn't want to make any comparisons that would be embarrassing if they were known, and so she said, you must never say this to anyone.
Warren, one more question. When you heard the news that your wife had won, what was your reaction?
Well, Barbara received a call from Dorothy Chalischek when she returned from France. She was on this tennis tour that Joanne Puy was conducting. Andre was the leader. And she said, she called me. I was in Chicago, the home of my parents. My name means winemaker son, by the way, but I have not an agricultural background. Vignarski is from a winemaker, a vintner. And my father, during Prohibition, did make wine. And my first experience of wine was sound. I heard bubbling of fermentation in a barrel in which he was making wine. I was in that home. Looks like there's more than an accident. I was in the home. Barbara called me from California and said, Dorothy Chalischek just called, and she said there was a tasting in Paris. Do you remember? I said, yeah. I don't exactly remember. She said, but we won. And I said, it's nice. We were just starting out. It's nice to win a tasting. I didn't know who the judges were. I didn't know what the other wines were. I didn't know anything about it. I remember Stephen coming to get the wine, but he didn't tell me that it was going to be tasted. It was going to be a beauty contest. So I had no way of knowing. And so I was very pleased when I found out I was in a state of joy, because those 10 years of apprenticeship seemed to have turned out all right.
Thank you, Warren. Now, Beau, the 1973 Chateau Montelena, first at the Paris tasting. What three words would you use to describe Chateau Montelena Winery in 1976?
Well, I was going to go with the young. Also, it was 40 years ago, so I was one of the youngest guys in law. I was just a cellar worker, but so I would say young, actually fairly confident, and a little bit amazingly hardworking and diligent. We were ambitious and driven. I would say was part of the things we do too. Like Warren, the long history of Napa Valley being making great wines pre-Prohibition, you know, we knew the history, and we thought we could get there again. So we knew that we had to, you know, do great grapes. And then once we had the new barrels and the training, I worked for guys, you know, Warren and to tell us how to train. So, but we were fairly ambitious and fairly confident, actually, that we knew we had really great grapes, and if we didn't screw it up, it'd be pretty good stuff.
Your dad was traveling in Bordeaux at the time and learned about the results and sent a telegram back to you all at Calistoga. Do you remember the reaction of receiving the telegram?
Yeah, it was a day that I remember. My boss was Mike Gergen's father's dad, and he's very, very, very Croatian. He was young too, and he's got the telegram from my dad, and he's gonna says, you know, also, my father repeated, not bad for kids in the sticks, you know, great news, Paris says we won, and you go to the winery, we still have the, you know, the document there, but he's like dancing around, we won, and he's like doing a Croatian jig, and so we, of course, come out of the cellar, we're just sitting there, you know, filling barrels regular day, and so pretty soon we were all hopping around, doing the Croatian jig.
So did the judges judgment of Paris influence your decision to really stay with winemaking, because you were young at that time?
Yeah, well, actually, I decided to go to Fresno State just before that. I had moved from the University of Utah down to Fresno. I was actually in summer school, not summer at Davis, before I went to Fresno. So, yeah, it was definitely a confirmation that I made the right decision, that the brilliant future of Napa Valley and American wine became obvious overnight. And when you grow up as an American, you think about meritocracy as everything. If you try hard enough, like Warren said, if you work hard enough and you're diligent, you put your nose to the grindstone, you can make these great rewards and you can actually accomplish great things, but you know, just by hard work. And yeah, clearly when we saw that meritocracy was crushing the aristocracy, it was a brilliant time for all of us.
You mentioned Mike as a mentor. Were there other mentors?
Oh yes, absolutely. You have to think there was other winemakers in the group that had, you know, Jerry Looper, for example, made the Fremark Abbey. He had two wines in the competition. He was my next mentor. Mike, of course, you know, he had such a great success with us and made such brilliant wines that, you know, clearly as the wine industry instantly exploded in California, Mike got a great opportunity and started his own house, which is, you know, everybody's dream, I think. And our next winemaker was Jerry Looper, and I trained under him. And we were really, actually the Chardonnay was a sidetrack for us. We've been a red wine house since we started. Our 100 acres at this date is all Cabernet. So Chardonnay is still a little sideline for us. It's a novel little experiment that worked out.
One quick question. As a member of the post-Paris tasting generation of winemakers in Napa, what have been some of the challenges?
The big challenge is that once we, you know, we got the meritocracy and then the American standard for quality, why we won was because our wine was a higher quality, or at that, you know, that day we had the right wine in the right place, we could compete on a level playing field, we were judged on pure quality. But I think when the, you know, center and the focus of American winemaking becomes on quality and competitiveness, and that set a track record that really is true to today, where the leadership of American wines and quality and integrity and honesty are dominated. So as we grew up in that, that became a very competitive league, and you had to be really good at your job, and you had to, again, really work hard. You know, it's a lot like baseball. The natural talent is enough. You also have to have discipline and training and good coaching and a lot of things. But basically, growing up, the age I did, we got tremendous opportunities when we were very young. I took over Montelena in 1982 when I was, you know, 93 years old yet. So, and it was very competitive. I had to follow in Mike's footsteps, and then Jerry Looper, and I'm, you know, 28 years old running this world-class winery, and it was very intimidating. So it was a little bit like you read about those guys that get battlefield promotions when the California wine business just exploded in the 70s, 80s. It was a good time to be a young man with a good skill set and a good work ethic.
Thank you. Violet, our first question for you is, how is your father? How's he doing?
My father's actually doing really well, but he senses regrets. His back, unfortunately, does not allow him to travel. So we thought he would be here in spirit, but he's still here in person. So, you know, I'm like my dad in many ways. Usually I like to say I have more hair, but he's a lot cuter. So.
Violet, what are your earliest memories of the Paris tasting, of your father talking about it?
Many memories, actually. I remember being very disappointed when we started our winery because we were on flat ground that was bare. There was no castle and there was no lake. So when I actually, you know, I spent a lot of time at the winery on the barrels and the lake, and every Saturday, Sunday, I would go there with my dad. And when he talked about the Paris tasting for the first time, he was sort of in shock. He was like, "This tasting in Paris, I can't believe I beat the French." And but I think the impact didn't really sink in until many years later, so.
What did you take away from the story, and how did it influence the road that you've taken in your life?
My father has told me his stories about growing up since the time I was born. So he was born in Croatia, as has been mentioned before, when it was part of Yugoslavia. My dad was born in a very small, very poor village where they made everything they produced. which included wine. He stopped grapes at an early age and apparently was weaned directly from breast milk to wine at the age of two. So he had a very happy childhood. But his father sent him away when he was 10 years old to go to school to get an education. And my dad remembers him crying and saying, "Mike, you know, the only thing I can give you is the opportunity to have education. And remember, every day, do your best, learn something new, and make a friend." And my dad remembered that his whole lifetime. He escaped communism to Germany, was in an internment camp for a while, went through Canada, but his goal was always to come to America to achieve his American dream of freedom and success. And when he arrived in Napa, he saw it was a new industry. A lot of people really excited about wine, passionate about it, but really wanting to do better. And one of the people who we barely mentioned here is Robert Mondavi. And he remembers Robert Mondavi as probably being the person who made the most impact for him. He worked first with Lee Stewart at U.D. Warren, and trained with him, with Father Timothy, with Andre Chelchev, and then he was also at Robert Mondavi. He actually made Robert Mondavi's 69 Cabernet, which put Robert Mondavi Winery on the map. So for those of you who think my dad is only Mr. Chardonnay, he's Mr. Cabernet as well. But he learned something from every single person that he studied, and he absorbed their knowledge. And so when he was a winemaker and partner at Chateau Montelena, he put all of that knowledge to use to make what he considered one of his finest achievements. And I think he's been growing strong ever since. That was 40 years ago, but he put Rudy Chills on the map as well with our 77 Chardonnay. And I think, you know, I was so intimidated by my dad's success and his ability to be, I can understand, Bo, they're very big shoes to fill. So even though I started in the cellar in the laboratory, I ended up going in a different direction, coming back to the winery. But over the years, the impact of the Paris tasting has been really big. And you know, it definitely opened up the world, you know, that you can make wines not just on French soil. But I also remember when I was a kid, you would go out to eat like, you know, once a month or something, and you would go out to a fancy French restaurant, and the food was so heavy, you couldn't eat for days afterwards. And so the fact that we now have a food network, that people cook and eat wonderful food every day and drink wine with it, is absolutely amazing. So I know I've gone on too long, but I just have to say my dad at the age of 93 just finished his memoirs and will actually have them available tonight. They're here at the Smithsonian Library. It's a great story, so.
We'll have them and Violet will be signing them.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Continue in this vein of what happened next after the Paris tasting. Ted Basler, you have been involved in the development of the wine industry in Washington State. Tell us about that.
Well, first off, I want to go back to Robert Mondavi, who said about this event in Paris that it was a victory for Napa, for California, and for all of North America. And just to put that in perspective, if you think about 40 years ago, in Washington State, there were 12 wineries. 40 years ago, in Oregon, there were fewer than 12 wineries. Today, in Oregon, there are 700 wineries. In Washington, 900 wineries and 60,000 acres of grapes. So the transformation from this event was clearly not just Napa, not just California. And in fact, around the world, people grew this inspiration from this event. It was so tremendous. The name Andre Chelchev has been mentioned several times tonight, and I just wanted to recognize Andre's influence. He was one of our consultants in the late 1960s. And he was very inspirational, a 4'11" winemaker who was bigger than life. He also happened to be the consultant to the Antonori family in Italy. And it was Andre who brought us together. And Piero Antonori came to the United States, he came to Washington, and we have a joint venture winery called Solari there. But it was with that Warren talked to Piero Antonori, he said, would you be interested in acquiring our estate? And he spoke with me, Piero spoke with me, and he said, you know, it would be our honor to be the custodians of this fantastic Nambawan estate. And we are very, very proud to have it in our portfolio. I would just like to make one more comment regarding the gigantic impact this event has. I mean, it really is one of the greatest events in wine history. And it was so big to see the change in attitude about other regions, other wines. And because of that, all American winemakers owe a debt to Stephen and George. And in fact, you know, we should all send them checks every month. But I did my part because Saturday night we served a 10-course dinner to Stephen, so that was down in Napa Valley.
Thank you very much, Ted.
So I've gotten the word here that it's time to open up for a few questions. If anyone has a question, we have some microphones there for you to ask the distinguished panel something you've always wanted to know about the Paris tasting. Go ahead.
I guess the question is for Bo and the Chardonnay in the movie Bob Shop of the Chardonnay Brown. So was the wine brown?
This is a bit of a so everybody knows this is a very elegant crowd. We know Kurosawa. Now stories change over the decades as they happen. So there's one version. I know that the wine pink, it's a post-balling instability when it's made super reductive. It's called pinking, you can look it up. It's a transitory thing. It was blown way out of proportion for the film to give one of the dramatic impacts. But so it is a post-balling transitory instability, and it's quite common. Stony Hill happens all the time. My daughter makes wine, it happens for a couple times at harvest. So yeah, it was not nearly such a big deal. But it's called pinking, you can look it up.
Throw my two cents in here too, because it was actually the 72 Chardonnay with which that happened. That was the first Chardonnay that my dad made at Montelena. And what happened was that there was a vacuum attachment that goes on the corker that was supposed to remove the oxygen. It actually was sort of a newfangled device, so most wines that were made were bottled without it. But that very first wine, the 72, things broke down, and that's what happened to it. It actually did not happen in 73.
And that's why it's the Rashomon, it's the Kurosawa story. Because my father would get it, he went to his grave swearing that it was in. The only one who told the story accurately is George, and he said it's ambivalent. Nobody really agrees. But one of the
other. The winemaker agrees.
We still won the tasting, for crying out loud.
Thank you.
Several winemakers, the owners of several wineries in the New York area. I said, you know, remember that there's this Paris tasting. What happened after that? You know, I had no idea when I started asking the question. And to a man, to a person, they all were saying, you will not believe it. The day after that story came out on a Monday, the next day or that day, people would come running into the store with a copy of Time magazine and say, do you have these wines? Do you have these wines? And most of them didn't have the wines, but then they turned around and started buying California wine. And so it And so overnight, it changed the reputation of California wine.
Warren, don't you have a story about trying to recall the wines? Yeah.
I remember a particular retailer to whom I presented that wine, and he said, "Why should I buy your wine? I can buy Chateau Gloria, it's the cheaper." And I'm thinking to myself, that wine is better than Chateau Gloria. But he was persuaded on the basis of price, no reputation, or inchoate reputation, but nothing like the Paris tasting. After the Paris tasting, he didn't remember, but I remember. I came back to that story. He said, your wine is better than Chateau Gloria. Well, that was an understatement, but it was much easier after that. And it was a partnership then, the winery, and I wanted to get back as many bottles as I could for future tasting. And my partner said, "Warren, we should be selling the wine, not buying the wine."
Sauvignon Beat La Tour, and that was the first time anyone had heard of Spain. I was the first person to import sherry and vintage port into Paris. No, the New World did not exist, not at all. She was the editor of the Revue de Vin de France. The same day, she realized right away what was going to happen. And she asked for her notes back. And I said, "Sorry, Madame Kahn, they're not your notes, they're now my notes." 2 weeks later, she wrote an article in the Revue de Vin de France saying the tasting had been rigged, and I'd spat in the face of France, and all that kind of stuff. I was physically thrown out of the Ramonet cellars. I called Mr. Ramonet. Because I had both the Bata Marache 72 and 73 in my shop. And Pierre Ramonet, who was known as Le Père Ramonet, had already been on the front cover of Go & Mio and said that God had put him on earth to make great wine. So I called Ramonet and I said, "I want to put one of your wines into a tasting, and I've got the 72 and 73. Which do you recommend?" He said, "Young man, all my wines are brilliant." So I put in the 73. Just to match the 73s in California, and it wasn't brilliant. So anyway, I was physically thrown out of the Ramonet cellars. So, but otherwise, putting a positive spin on it, Aubert de Vilaine, who was given a really bad time in Burgundy when he went back, announced a few years later that it was a welcome kick in the pants for France. And I was interviewed by Le Monde recently before coming out here, because they're going to have, Le Monde is going to publish on the 24th of June a big article on New World wines. And I had to translate. I said, I'd forgotten what it is in French, but a kick in the pants. And he said, un coup dans la derrière. That's what happened.
I think we have time for one more.
Warren mentioned that there were some French astronomers present at the tasting. I'm an astronomer, so I'm curious who they were.
One thing, the film Bottle Shock has been mentioned, which was based around Montalena, and I'd like to say that a movie has been written by Robert Kamen, who's a well-known screenwriter, and it will be called The Judgment of Paris, and I think it's due to be filmed in the Paris studios of Luc Besson in July or August, and it will be based around the dreams of Warren Wieniawski.
Would like to let everybody know that Patricia Gallagher, who wasn't able to be with us this evening, has sent us for the National Collections 4 wine glasses from the Academie du Vin, along with a register from the Academy. So we will have your history here as part of the National Collections of the American Food and Wine History Collections. So we're really very glad for that. And Warren, you
know, just getting back for a minute to the astronomy question. I think, in fact, for the wine world, this was a Copernican moment.
To taste some wine, and you may exit out the back or here by the stage. As you exit, you should pick up your wine glass, which you can keep. There is a book here for you to taste. It has tasting notes, so you can make your own notes as well. And there will also be activities and book signings on the West End. And I want to say one more special thanks to our